I really think the most important thing that a teacher can do is help students build their self-esteem. I always think that if my students take away nothing more than feeling good about themselves, who they are, what they can accomplish, then I've helped them work on something that's going to change their lives in every aspect.
Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
Welcome to episode 89 of the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, and thanks so much for listening again. My name is Tim Topham, and I'm the teacher behind the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the piano teaching blog at timtopham.com, and the Inner Circle community. My passion is supporting creative piano teaching, whether that's through podcasts like this one or the hundreds of articles on my blog, my training courses, downloads, lesson plans, all the benefits of membership of my community. The goal is the same. It's about holding your hand when you need it, pushing you along, giving you a heap of great ideas, and helping you set and achieve your teaching goals. Today's show notes and a full transcript, as usual, are available at timtopham.com/episode89. In today's episode, we're going to be chatting with one of the world's best-loved composers, authors, and arrangers, all about ideas for effective teaching. And we're also going to dive into the sometimes hard-to-grasp world of helping students get started with some basic arranging. My guest today has composed, authored, and arranged over 300 published titles for piano students. An experienced piano teacher herself, she's presented numerous piano teaching workshops throughout the United States, Canada, England, New Zealand, and Australia. She's well known for her famous and fun series published by Alfred Music. And I know when everyone hears that, they're going to know exactly who I'm talking about. Welcome to the show, Carol Matz.
Thank you so much, Tim. I appreciate you having me on.
I'm very sorry that I wasn't really in the piano teaching game so much back in 2008 when you were in Australia. So tell us about your trip. Where did you go, and what kind of things were you doing with Alfred then?
Where I went was pretty much everywhere. Right. I started in Auckland, and then I hit Cairns, Townsville, Brisbane, Sydney, Canberra, Melbourne, Perth.
Wow.
Whirlwind tour in about 3 weeks' time, I believe. But that was great because I actually asked them to build in some days here and there for me because I'm a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. So I had to like go do stuff and really see Australia because, you know, flying all the way from Florida. So yeah. I got to do some pretty cool things. Took a helicopter over the Great Barrier Reef.
Nice.
And then like ran back to go to the airport, and anytime I had 5 minutes to myself, I was doing something. It was really enjoyable.
Yeah, exhausting though too. That's a lot of distance to travel. For those who don't know Australia, I mean, Cairns to Melbourne, where I live, is 4 hours. Melbourne to Perth is 4 hours. In other countries, you're traveling in Europe. You've crossed a number of time zones, right, in different countries. So that would have been a full on schedule, I tell you what.
Well, it's a good thing I'm 21. You're laughing.
No, I'm not. So look, I've been teaching your music for a number of years now. Your Famous and Fun series, I know lots of piano teachers listening will be nodding their heads going, yeah, what an awesome series. You just made these often traditional arrangements just so appealing suddenly. More recently, we connected on Facebook and I found out all about the other work that you're doing, and it's not just the Famous and Fun series. You've got much more behind you than just that. And it sounds like, let's face it, we've got some very similar ideals about teaching, I think.
Oh, yeah.
So what do you see as the top three things that teachers really need to prioritize in order to get the most out of their teaching that perhaps they're not doing right now?
It's a complicated question, and I'm going to answer it probably more philosophically than you want me to, but perhaps it'll be useful to teachers. I really think the most important thing that a teacher can do is help students build their self-esteem. I always think that if my students take away nothing more than feeling good about themselves, who they are, what they can accomplish, then I've helped them work on something that's going to change their lives in every aspect. Now, obviously, I think you and I both feel that we know that not every student is going to be a concert pianist or a jazz pianist playing gigs, you know. So just having that ability to play piano, maybe play for a few friends or family members, that can really do a lot for a kid's sense of self, self-worth. I mean, I remember when I was probably in middle school, we were on a school trip and we were in an auditorium and I had a piano. So I went over and I am dating myself now. I started playing all the new Billy Joel songs. and the other kids were hanging around and they were singing. And it honestly just made me feel really, you know, cool and accepted. You know, I was that girl who's good on piano. So it's kind of an identity. So self-esteem for sure. And that brings me to what I think is another really important thing. And that's socialization with music. And I know you feel the same way. If students have the basic skills to play music socially with other kids, they're usually encouraged to keep playing. And that's one reason why I think it's important to teach chords and playing from lead sheets and playing chord charts so students can join a band or they can accompany singers in a school talent show, things like that. I played guitar in high school. I played bass. And it was really easy for me to just, you know, go and, you know, grab my guitar and play along. And, you know, I knew how to read music, but all I needed to do was learn chords like, you know, any other guitar student is taught nowadays. So I think that that's important to keep an eye on those skills that allow students to bring what they learn in their piano lessons to social situations. Third, It's pretty obvious that I'm interested in making lessons fun, famous and fun, but especially through the use of technology. I think it's super important to keep them motivated, to really stay with it. All kids that you're teaching right now are what they call, they're different names, but Generation Z. And they expect technology. They're not like wowed by it, like I think that some of us are, that's new to us. They do it in school. And so that's, I think, a very important element to keep them engaged.
Yeah, technology is very, it's not a wow thing for them at all. And we do have to keep that in mind. We think it's very exciting that we're going to try out this new app with a student. They're like, oh, yeah, that's kind of cool. I still get students excited by a note reading game or something like that. But really, when it comes to technology too, we've got to work out why we're using it. That's what I always try and remind piano teachers. Why are you using it? It can't just be for the fun and 5 minutes. I mean, sometimes that's good, but really we have to think about why, what are we trying to achieve and which tool actually will help us get us there quickly.
Right, absolutely.
You covered a heap of ground in those first couple of minutes, seriously. So I just want to go back because I don't want to miss out on anything that you've talked about. So you first talked about identity, and I'm big on this one as well. And that spot that students get to, well, that we hope that they get to, particularly in their early to mid-teens, where they start calling themselves a musician. And thinking of themselves is like, I'm a pianist, I can play it. And all my friends know that Tim's the piano guy, like you said. That is such an important hurdle to get over. And I guess it's kind of moving up a hill, and you kind of, once you're over that hill and a student identifies as a musician, then we've gone a huge distance to helping them play for the rest of their life, in my opinion. The question is, though, how do we help our students get that identity? Have you got any tips on that or thoughts?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, even a kid who is really only going to play a song for their parent, you would be surprised, even just parent approval, playing at a recital. All right, I'm going to tell you a dirty secret. I go on YouTube and I put my name in, but it's not for the ego trip. It's really, I sit there and I get teary-eyed. I choke up because I really do want to see all the kids who are using my stuff in, you know, some random church in Iowa or whatnot. And, you know, because it's easy for writers to work in a vacuum and, you know, you only know your own students. But then I've seen, like, you know, where, you know, the kid turns around and they're beaming at their dad, shooting the video of them. And that right in and of itself matters a lot, especially to kids who have certain issues, shyness or whatever it might be. That in and of itself is really important right there. Beyond that, as far as identifying as a pianist, you know, I really do think that it is the ability to play socially because being a musician can be a very isolating thing the way being a writer is. You know, it's you're in a little bubble and you're practicing and who hears you, your teacher, maybe your parents. So if kids can make that a thing, that when they're in their social settings, they can use those tools. they can be that kid who's good on piano. And like I said, my nephew took piano lessons from me for a while. We had a little bit of we were living at a greater distance and I couldn't teach him. And the other day he says, the other week he says to me, "Oh, I really want to learn how to play guitar. Can I go get an electric guitar?" So that was great. I went with my sister's money and got him this really great electric guitar, showed him how to crank up the distortion and showed him how to play bar chords. And all of a sudden, he's got this sense about himself because he can have friends over and they can jam. It's harder to do that on the piano because piano students are often just, the emphasis is so much on teaching how to read. I don't know any student, I used to teach guitar as well, and they don't want to sit there and, pluck out little, melodies on the high E string like, they used to teach guitar. Now they're just like, give me the chords, give me the little, chord frames, tell me where to put my fingers and how to strum. If it were that easy with piano, it'd be great, but guess what? It kind of can be.
Yeah, totally.
I'm not advocating, throwing out the window the idea of teaching students how to read. I think that that's extremely important. But I'm saying as a supplementary philosophy, that's really important to work in all the stuff that you always talk about that I've done, for teaching for how many ever years.
Mm. The social aspect and playing in groups, I think, is crucial. I totally agree. And I know myself that I was pushed as a pianist to become a percussionist in my school orchestra, and then I became a drummer in the band. And that was my connection. I didn't even really want to do it. And someone, the head of music, said, "Tim, you're clearly musical. We need some percussionists. Go and try it out." And I love it. And I've now encouraged any of my students to either play another instrument, and an instrument that's a solo in a band, or to go and sing in a choir or do something that involves music in groups. I think you've hit the nail on the head. So important for that identity.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that we have to suddenly start teaching groups either. We're not talking about the lessons having to be social, although that's great. I think we're talking about just the opportunity for students to either play with other instruments and having those chord, but the chord background can really help there, or to be encouraged to play at school assemblies and things like that. And then that's how, "Oh, Carol, yeah, she's the girl that's always playing at assembly. She's a pianist." Yeah.
Exactly.
Look, many teachers have loved the Famous and Fun series. How did you first get into the arranging side of things?
Well, actually, I studied composition, arranging, and orchestration at the University of Miami. And they've got this world-class concert jazz band, like a big band. And I was able to compose some really advanced level stuff for them, which was really great to hone my arranging skills. And I also got to write for the university orchestra. And it turns out that there are a lot of concepts and approaches that you can use in writing, high level material, ensemble stuff that can be incorporated into writing for piano students. And I remember because, I'm not a huge jazz person, even though that was my concentration, because I was really, I'm a theory geek. I wanted to get into all of the jazz theory and really understand, the guts. And for me, I said to my professor, I'm like, "Well, so I'm going to write for big band. I mean, so Johnny Carson already had Doc Severns, and what am I going to do?" And he said, "All of the principles that you're going to learn, you're going to be able to apply across the board to writing for whatever you want to write for." And he's absolutely true. And I learned a lot of things that I have applied to teaching arranging, to creating my own arrangements as well. I'd be happy to share a couple with you.
Are you up? You up for playing something? Is that what you mean?
Oh, no, I got my piano too far away from that. just to even discuss a couple things.
Absolutely. Well, I want to move on to the whole arranging thing because.
Yeah, sure.
We both know Forrest Kinney and his work trying to get the chordal aspect and the arranging aspect happening, but it really is, it's a big leap for teachers. Even teaching chords and lead sheets is a bit of a leap, but then saying, "Okay, we've got a piece, let's help a student arrange it," it's like, where do we even start? So I would love to have a discussion on that to help teachers,
Well, first of all, and I'm going to riff a little bit on what your doctrine is too, because I share the same philosophy. To backtrack a little bit, I'm really big on teaching chords to students at early levels. And I've put an emphasis on learning scales and chords actually in my interactive piano method, because I know how chords changed me completely as a musician. It laid an amazing foundation for me to be able to play pop and jazz, from lead sheets to transpose, to compose and arrange. And students who have a very developed knowledge of chords, they can really feel the landscape or the topography of the keyboard fluently. And that's essential to all of those things, including arranging. When I was 11 years old, actually, I was taking classical lessons. I was doing the whole nine yards, but I was obsessed with the Beatles. I'm still obsessed with the Beatles. But I wanted to play pop and rock. And my teacher wanted me to play Kabalevsky, which to this day I'm boycotting. So my mom, I told my mom I wanted to quit piano. She was totally upset because she's an amazing classical pianist. So she said, just keep playing the piano. And this was a big lesson for me. She said, you could take a break and go back to it later. And then I played piano even more. I got a big Beatles fake book and I started out how to play some of the songs from the chord symbols by matching the chord symbols up with the written part. And I learned a lot about chord structure from doing this. I never forget this. I remember having that light bulb moment when I realized what a minor seven chord was when I was learning Penny Lane. It's like F minor seven. Oh, this is an F. This is an F minor. Add the E flat. So that kind of came together. So I think that to teach students chords and arranging, keep it simple. You don't have to get into a ton of theory. You don't have to talk about major triads made up of two superimposed thirds. I mean, you know, forget that. Let them deal with that in university. But
well, it's counterproductive, isn't it, to go too deep into the theory? Yeah.
As much as I love to talk about it, and like I know that you and I are probably going to, you know, talk again so we can sit there and, you know, talk about theory and no one else lets me. But I would usually start around the late elementary level and teach all the white key major and minor triads. Now, I don't bother with the staff. Instead, I place an emphasis on really like the chord shapes. So like when I teach, I don't know if you do this, when I teach white key majors, I'll show the different groupings. So if, for example, of course, the C, F, and G major chords are all white keys. So they keep in one category, C, F, G. Then D, E, and A all have one black key in the middle, and that kind of forms a triangle shape. Mm-hmm. If you will. And then I always tell the kids B is the oddball, so deal with it. But what's cool about the grouping of shapes is that they stay, obviously, in minor, but in reverse. So now you still have C, F, G, but now C minor, F minor, G minor are the little triangle shapes with the one black key in the middle and so forth. I think it's really important, whether it's learning to arrange, improvise, compose, anything, that you get students to be able to envision things on the keyboard. And teaching almost by this shape really helps students think on the piano. And not so much on the staff, because that eliminates the intimidation factor of so much staff reading. I remember being in university theory class, and I could just picture a keyboard in my head. And if the professor said, okay, now what's in a whatever chord, I would just picture the keyboard in my mind and rattle it off. Meanwhile, trombone players are like moving their arms in and out, you know.
Poor trombone players.
So that's not a very visual thing. So we're very lucky that we play piano, and that's why they make everyone who goes to get a degree study piano. And you can really just see it all laid out. So that's what I encourage teachers to do. Keep it simple. Teach by shape, a little bit by, envisioning on the piano.
Just on that.
Unless you interrupt, so please do.
Learning shapes, I find... Yeah. Is students will find that interesting for about a minute. And then unless we put that into a context, it's very boring, right? And they won't actually practice it. So how do you get students to actually practice being able to move between those shapes?
Right. Okay. So one of the things that I do that I think is kind of useful, I use my own shorthand for inversions. Now, to backtrack a little bit, I do get them playing simple 1-4-5 songs immediately.
And do you get them playing along to a YouTube, or have you got a backing track, or do you just put a beat on? What do you do?
When I was doing a lot of chord-based teaching, right, I've spent a lot of time recently, piloting my own method, so it's been more heavy on that stuff. But I didn't I didn't draw a lot of technology into that. I wanted them to feel like they were not needing so much support. It was more like, here's 1, 4, 5. Now, here are all the songs you can play. Mm-hmm. And then do something that I know that you do, and that's play the chords in the right hand with a single note, or if they can reach an octave in the left hand with different rhythms. And this is kind of like a comping 101.
Yeah, it is. And, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And when they have that basic skill, then they can, you know, start to, you know, take that further. What I was getting to was what I do with my little shorthand for inversions. And what's cool about that is I have this trick. And if you want to, I teach students what an inversion is, obviously, on the piano, not on staff. And then what I'll do is I'll use like a little superscript number one for first inversion. So it'll be like C1 up top, and that means C first inversion. G2 will have a little superscript two, and so forth. So what they do in order to not have that sound where they're just playing all these parallel chords, you know, up and down, jumping around the keyboard, this gets them to be able to play and feel the common chord progressions with some good voicings instead of, you know, doing the jump around. So if you can picture F first inversion, C second inversion, G root, mm-hmm. right? So there's like, you know, just a basic, you know, way that you can get the kids. And then they go, oh, that sounds pretty good. Then I'll write out kind of what I would...
Sounds like a pop song already, right?
That's like Fatboy Slim, Praise You, right?
Yeah, I get it.
Praise you like I should. I don't want to sing. But yeah, so, and then what I'll write out, and I just pulled that out of my hat, but what I'll do is kind of like write out, since they can read rhythms, I'll write out kind of like what I would do with guitar students, like a strum or a comping rhythm. So like 1, 2, 3, 4. And then they'll play the F for the two beats, and then the C for the two beats, and then, I mean, the G, yeah, the C for the two beats, and then G. So I'll do that like a chord chart and start with that. And then you wouldn't believe, they're like very excited because, well, you would, because now, ooh, I sound like I'm a pianist. They're moving forward. And yeah, there's a certain degree of memorization. I mean, truthfully, I'm a combination of like, I'm like a very strict fun teacher, you know, it's kind of like, you know, do what you have to do and I'll be really fun. But so I'll get them to actually play. They do the groupings, and then I'll actually have them play with one finger in the left hand, like together, right, left. So they'll do the C and they go to D and they go to E and they do all the chords with that rhythm up and back. And then I'll have them do minors, and then I'll just like throw it out, like, okay, play a D, play an F, play an A, you know? And so it's kind of like a, you know, I always say to the kids, this isn't rocket science. You memorize a bunch of dates in school, you know, what year was this battle fought? Here, learn what this shape is, and you will open up a whole world to yourself.
Yeah. So the two kind of ways of practicing then is either moving up in a chord shape chromatically or through the white notes, but adding some kind of rhythmic context to make it more interesting.
Exactly.
Or giving them a small progression,
right,
like that one that we just did, that actually sounds musical, but they're still practicing the chords and the inversions.
Right. And let's say that, you know, you can even, as you know, they're just the same chord progressions are regurgitated over and over in pop music. So if they learn 1, 5, minor 6, 4, then they can play Let It Go from Frozen. They can play Adele, Someone Like You. They can play Katy Perry, Hot and Cold. So, you know, give them that one and then go, oh, and then I'll sing along and embarrass them. And then I'll be like, oh, you can sing along in the privacy of your home. But then they feel like he's talked about being a musician.
Mm, yep. And I love getting students to sing. It makes them so uncomfortable sometimes. But, you know, if you take the lead and you sing, and I'm not the world's best singer, I can sing in tune, that's about it, they get the idea and you can start drawing it out of them. And the more pianists play, you know, play the accompaniment while they sing, the more fun they have with pop music. Trying to play the pop rhythms of the melody is always difficult. I'm trying to encourage teachers to do it less, unless the song is quite easy. Actually, there was one of my students brought in It was an 80s tune. It was like Tears for Fears or something like that. And I've put it aside because it actually has a rhythm in the melody. I don't know if it was that one. But it has a melodic rhythm that is actually 100% playable. It only uses quavers and crotchets, so quarter and eighth notes, which is unheard of. And it sounds cool. So I'm going to look that one up and share it with people. Oh,
that's cool. Excellent. So you really did ask me about arrangements, and I digressed a little bit. And so
I think it was great, though. The first step for you is that you're starting late in elementary. So how many years or months would you start this with students?
Well, it really depends on the kid. And it also depends on whether they're the kind of kid, like I said, I do a lot of traditional teaching. And I feel out the kid, you know, in terms of like, well, what do you really want to do? And if they say, oh, I want to play pop, and then I'll give them some of my big note stuff or whatever. And if that's not satisfying, then it's kind of like, oh, well, I want to learn this Coldplay song or whatever. So I can kind of like, you know, write out a little riff for them and then have them, you know, do the comping or something like that. So it to me, like I say, when I say late elementary, I'm not really quite sure what the leveling is, you know, internationally. I know everybody's got their own different, you know, parameters, but I would say, you know, they know how to use connected pedal, you know, pedal changes. They can read, like you say, up to the dotted quarter and eighths, sorry, dotted quaver. Quavers. It's like doing math in my head, I'm sorry. And you know, once you can kind of like get them to that point, then it's, you know, it depends on how many years, like you say, how many years. I mean, I've started off kids where they like, I don't want to read, I just want to do this. And then I'll use that as a tool to kind of get them to have a feeling of the piano and not be afraid of it. And then we'll kind of work in reading as well.
Yeah. I certainly never push kids. I push kids to learn chords, but I don't push them to play pop unless they want to. Right. And more often than not, if you suggest a pop song, it often won't inspire them if it's not music that they want to learn. So I'll always open the door, though, and say, you know, what would you like to learn? I think that's a great question. That said, yeah, I do have a post on my site about the top 10 pop songs for piano students, because there are some easy songs, as you've already mentioned, that use those simple 1-4-5-6 chords. Some of the Beatles, I can't think off the top of my head who else is there, but Adele. And I find that most students know those songs and are eager to play them. And people keep commenting and adding new ones, which is really good too. So I'll make sure we share that post in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I always say beware of what we call in the business ice cream songs. It's like we used to, I don't know if, you know, I did a lot of the, for a while, I did all of the big note arranging for Alfred, and my good buddy Dan Coates did all the easy piano, and we kind of divvied up some of the work. And we used to laugh because we would try to pick pieces, whether, you know, we didn't have the Beatles, but if it's, you know, something that we knew was going to have longevity, we'd be all excited. Because otherwise, they're what they call ice cream tins, because by the time you public, you know, do the arrangements and you publish it and the music's out, it, you know, it melts.
Yes, 6 months out, I see what you mean.
The kids are like, I can't play that. So you have to really kind of think about teaching the songs that have some kind of longevity to them. Mm. And like when you say Beatles and Adele, I mean, yes, they're you know, ones that kids are going to continue to know. And you know, I still encourage teachers to, you know, not be up in any ivory towers about music. I am a huge rock and roll fan. I know I listened to a podcast where you're talking about how you're a house person,
dance music. Yeah.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, my listening is all over the place, but you know, I grew up with Beatles, Led Zeppelin, and moved into like, you know, the grunge, Stone Temple Pilots, Chili Peppers, see them in 2 weeks, cool. You know, things like that. Yeah. And no, did I love Katy Perry personally? Not so much, but I listened to it. And whenever, you know, whatever my students wanted to do at the time, listen to Lady Gaga, become familiar with it so you can kind of demystify it for yourself.
So let's say, let's take this another step further. Let's say a student can play a simple song. Let's in fact, let's get away from the pop for a second. Let's go to just a simple tune that they've learned from a lead sheet. It might be a hymn or a folk melody or something like that.
Sure.
And they can play a melody, they can play some chords in their left hand or however they're doing it. Can you take us through a couple of steps about how we could help them arrange it now?
Absolutely. I always think about piano arrangements as having three basic elements. Obviously the melody, the harmony or the chords, and then there's the groove, the beat. I always tell my students to work from the outside in. I tell them to picture like if you're going to the kitchen and making a sandwich. You know, first you start with the two slices of bread on the outside. So one slice would be the melody, which is usually on top. And then you've got that groove, that beat, that rhythm, and that is defined in the left hand. Then you put whatever you want inside the sandwich, which, you know, is more of the heart of the harmony. So for example, to break it down, first thing you want to do is make sure that the student can play the melody well without looking at the music. So you want, we never want to, it's kind of like engaging two different parts of the brain. It's easier to deal with one part of the brain at a time, you know, to have them worrying about notation, to have them worrying about reading notes and figuring out how to write it on the staff. It's just too much. So it's easier for the kid to be more creative and flexible if they're just thinking about looking at the piano. So getting them to play step one, getting them to play the melody well without looking at the music. The second thing they'll do is the other part of the sandwich, the bottom part of the bread. And that is a step, figure out what kind of piece it is and establish a left-hand groove. Is it a pop or rock piece? Needs a strong rhythm? Like you're saying, dotted quarter note, eighth beat, maybe using fifths in the left hand or octaves. Or if they want to do like a pop ballad or any kind of ballad, like you say, a traditional piece with a beautiful melody, that might call for some left hand patterns like broken triad accompaniments or one of the great standby patterns for the left hand, you know, going root fifth and then an octave higher, like C, G, C.
I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, I think you have. Made a living off CGC. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then even for doing ballads, it's even cool to go the one, the five, and then put the three on top.
That's nice.
It's like actually a tenth higher. So I, even though students can't reach it, I certainly can. I have small hands. But pressing the pedal and being able to do that arpeggiation, that's a great, or going, you know, 1-5, 1-2-3, like 1-5, 8-9-10, you know, that's like that old, you know, great. But once students can do that and they can do it with the pedal, they can really do all kinds of things. So the bottom line is you want the student to pick a type of accompaniment that conveys the piece's overall feel. So they can use harmonic intervals. They can use broken intervals, broken triads, waltz pattern, stride, boogie woogie, some other form of ostinato. And I know you have a really fantastic resource that teachers can use on those left hand patterns. So now they've got the bread. They've got the outside slice.
Okay, so we've got they know the melody off by heart. That's the top piece of bread. They've got a left hand pattern. That's the bottom bit of bread. So now we're filling it.
Right. Now we're putting in the middle. And so, making our song sandwich here. I love that. So, how do you incorporate? That's the most challenging part.
I'm making a song sandwich. I really like
song sandwich. Oh, I'm just making a song sandwich. incorporating harmony into that framework. Now, obviously, if the left hand is doing some type of broken chord accompaniment, the harmony is kind of built in, but only to an extent. Now, good arrangement isn't going to come from one melody note at a time in one hand and an individual harmonic note in the left hand. Otherwise, all you're ever going to have are two notes playing at the same time. So I encourage students to fill in the middle, and they can easily do that in two ways. And it's what I do when I'm arranging stuff as well. First, ask them to try adding some chord tones to the right hand melody here and there. They're obviously not harmonizing every note of the melody, but even on beat one, on the downbeat of each measure. And it's an as-needed thing, and that's where I work with them on playing and guiding them into hearing when something sounds a little thin, getting into like texture and so forth.
So that's adding an interval of a chord tone with the melody note every now and
the
then.
The melody in the right hand. And if you look at pop arrangements or any other arrangements for that matter, yeah, that's exactly what happens. The melody ends up being in the top. You know, it's in your pinky if you're playing like a sixth or something like that. So they're adding in filling notes, and their knowledge of chords will help.
Hmm. But you're not getting them to put a full chord underneath it in the right inversion sort of thing.
They don't have to, no. And, you know, not until later. I mean, there's so many levels to teach this, but I think I was coming at, like, trying to do the, you know, younger student kind of lesson. Great. Yeah. So, and it has to also be comfortable to the hand. So you've probably noticed, I mean, man, there's so much piano music out there. Surprise, piano teachers don't arrange pop music all the time. You know, thankfully, Dan Cutts and I have both done a lot of teaching and know what kids can play. But a lot of the straight transcriptions are not done by pianists or piano teachers. It's really just, you know, they're trying to shove all the notes in there and make it all sound, you know, like what it's supposed to be.
Which sounds great in Sibelius.
Yes.
When you press play, but that's about it.
Yeah. No. So it has to be pianistic. So what, you know, if a kid has, you know, we're talking about, even if it's, you know, a 10-year-old and you're looking at, you know, their hand size and they're only really going up to a sixth. So then you're going to encourage them. Oh, what note would go under there? Would that be, oh, here's a C in my left hand. The melody note is an E. Well, okay, that sounds nice. Well, what about filling out that chord a little? In the right-hand thumb, play a G. So now you've got a sixth in the right hand, and so forth. And how to make, you know, thirds and sixths and fourths. And I just start with intervals instead of, like, entire chunks. And they don't have to understand what inversion they're playing necessarily. Mm,
I like that, because that is a huge, complex factor for students to understand.
Yeah. Yes. When I was talking earlier about getting into, you know, learning inversions and being able to feel inversions, that's more like, you know, thinking about chord chart reading where it's important. But as far as arranging, you know, it really is a matter of thinking about things like that, like texture and filling in things. Where does this meet, you know, and then to not get stuck in only having this repeating left hand pattern that's going to just go on ad nauseum. You know, you want to kind of have them mix it up instead of, you know, once in a while do some blocked chords or intervals in the left hand, get some variation going with their left hand pattern. And a really important thing, this is probably the greatest arranging tip I could tell anyone, whether it's a student or an adult, that I've just realized I do natively, put the melody in the left hand. You know, and that's one of those things that I was going to talk about, like, you know, that I learned from large ensemble writing. You know, if you're writing for a big band, it's like that trumpet player is not going to have any lips tomorrow if all he does is play, you know,
the melody.
Yeah, the high notes the entire time. So when you're orchestrating, you're constantly thinking about where to pass the melody, have it go from, you know, from the violins to the cellos, from the trumpets to the trombones, etc. So the same thing with piano, you've got two hands and it's a really great thing. And also with the pieces in the interactive method, I've really made a concerted effort to write things so that left hand melodies are featured. Anyone who's arranging, it breaks up the monotony and really can, it just kind of like break things wide open. So all of a sudden the left hand is not providing that pulse. So maybe now the right hand has to provide that pulse. Well, what's it going to do? Is it just going to, you know, do some fifths up top? Is it going to do like little broken chord kind of accompaniment? One other thing that I think also is a huge thing to talk about in general with arranging, and I think kids catch on to this pretty quickly, and that is static versus dynamic, which means motion versus not motion, no motion. So if you've got this busy melody, a lot of eighth notes in it or so forth, you don't want a busy accompaniment. You want to balance that out. So if the melody is kind of slow and it's just a couple notes per measure, that's when you want to add more activity into the left-hand part. So it's always kind of this little conversation, this little balancing act between the hands. And, you know, to be honest, that is really where I find myself helping students most in the lesson.
Wow. Okay. That was such a great overview. No, I totally love it. So we've got the sandwich analogy. We're going to make a song sandwich. I really like this. So melody first, picking a left-handed, we should reiterate, or we should state that, of course, when you're arranging, one of the fun parts of arranging is that you can change the feeling of a piece.
Right.
So a pop song could become a classical Mozart arrangement, or a Mozart-y hymn or something like that could become a dance tune. And that's the fun of it.
With an Alberti bass, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that, you know, puts a smile on people's face. So choosing the left hand is important, but you don't have to stick to what the style of the piece is. We can always change that. And getting students to explore different ones, perhaps the teacher could play the right hand melody while the student explores a couple of really different patterns.
Yes.
An Alberti versus a boogie versus the pop root five octave. See which one they like. So that were kind of the first steps. And then in the filling in, your suggestion was just to add some simple chord tones depending on the texture and encourage students to listen for when that would be good without worrying about which inversion am I in, how many chord notes can I fit under this melody note and that sort of thing, which I really like. So it's keeping it nice and simple. And then you were talking, the last couple of steps or ideas was that you don't have to keep the melody in the right hand. So flick it over to the left hand. And then the student has the challenge of, well, what do I do with my right hand? And I haven't created a right hand pattern sheet because that can be something that you can do.
I'll send it to, I'll go straight for you.
And then that last step, which is so important, is balancing. So balancing both the activity between the right and left hand, and also making sure the left hand doesn't just repeat. I love giving students left-hand patterns, but as soon as they get this one, you know, one of those kind of pop patterns, they will use it through an entire arrangement so easily if you don't tell them to stop, because they love the sound of it.
Yeah.
So helping them balance and listen as they're going, I think, fantastic. What a great summary. And look, the thing I want teachers to realize is that we've covered a lot of ground today, but you can start really, really simply. And I really like starting this from, you know, method book one, or, you know, one of the first few method books. If a student can play a simple right-hand melody, then just get them to play along some fifths in the left hand that's not what might be written originally, or to explore a bit of a left-hand pattern, depending on their level. You don't have to make this complex, and you can get started pretty early on, I think.
Absolutely. And that is an important, when you said fifths, I started really nodding because, you know, little hands, that is tough to sometimes get those triads moving if they're real beginners. And fifths are, you know, so much music. You just kind of like put a fifth left hand to it. And then they can play a sixth by raising their thumb or lowering their pinky. So you can kind of get a little bit more harmony, the outer shell of a chord like that. Very important.
Well, you've mentioned a couple of times your interactive piano method. Tell us a little bit more about this. What compelled you to write your own method when there are so many out there already? Are you crazy or what?
I absolutely am crazy. Well, this has really been something I've dreamed about doing for a while. And one thing that drove me is because I fear how behind the curve so much of the piano world is. You know, like we talked about, kids aren't satisfied with, if you hand them a printed theory book to write in, you know, do it with a pencil, when the rest of their lives are interactive. Technology's made everything so much more engaging. And, you know, like we said, this generation of kids expects that type of engagement. Now, while there have been a ton of apps hitting the market, many of them are best suited to use as a supplement to whatever method book the teacher might be using. So up until now, when I've written the interactive method, there hasn't been a fully integrated method that uses technology at its core. So the interactive method has basically, it's all the materials carefully correspond unit by unit to the main lesson book so that you can have it as a professionally printed book, or a PDF download, which is nice for you who do not live in the United States.
Thank you very much. Yes, very helpful.
Well, so I actually did think about designing it for my Kiwi and Aussie friends and friends on. I really did, because I was thinking, you know, everything is a little too U.S. centric sometimes, and I think that it will translate to students everywhere. So as teachers become increasingly comfortable with putting a PDF on their tablet, like an iPad or any Android tablet, they can go ahead and use different apps to write on the PDF and use that as their main, quote, book. So it's not a stack of books, because they have their main lesson book. Then they go online to do activities that correspond with what they just learned.
So they'll give us some examples.
Yeah. There are like theory games, virtual flashcards, ear training, note spelling, and it's all accessed online. The materials are web-based, so it's not an app that you have to decipher.
And so it works on any device.
Any device, so that you can do it on any computer or tablet. The only thing that's needed to do that element is that they need to have internet access. And what's really cool and makes it interactive is that the website gives the students immediate feedback. It tells them when they've got something right. They can see when they got it wrong. And they can keep, we talked about how to engage, you know, students. It can be reset. Each activity can be reset, so the student can actually do it over and over and try to beat their high score like a video game. Instead of having kids sit right in their living room, messing around with a video game, they can sit there with their tablet on the sofa and work on ear training, for example. And then there are all kinds of PDF downloads, performance pieces, sight reading activities, two tracks of technique, which emphasize learning scales, chords, and arpeggios a little earlier than some standard methods. And then, of course, there's MP3 tracks that also come as practice tracks. So the students can download that to their phone or whatever and play along at home with the teacher duet part. So that to me is, you know, that was really the compelling thing. I think that our industry has kind of been dragging its feet, and then a glut of apps kind of emerged. And then, you know, again, of course, you know, you have to learn every single app, and then they only want to use it in the lesson. So then, oh, it's only available on an iPad. Not all my students have iPads. So anybody who has internet access can use this. So that's kind of really what drove me. And also, like, when you talk about like folk tunes or familiar pieces or whatever, another thing that makes the interactive method stand out is that I've included lots of arrangements of familiar pieces, even at the early levels, within a method, meaning there were great constraints on what could be done, but I had a lot of time. Yeah. So, you know, and again, I've got those left-hand melodies to improve bass staff reading. When you're talking about left-hand melodies, not just good for arrangements, but kids are not as good at bass clef reading as they are treble clef, obviously. And that is because all the melodies are in the
right hands.
Yeah. So they're just reading and playing more right-hand notes. So it's kind of, I want to have something very all-in-one, integrated, comprehensive, listening and memorization activities built into different pieces, emphasis on moving around the keyboard, not getting locked into a position, using the pedal, intervallic reading, physical movement, you know, lots of cool stuff. So it was kind of like my, okay, you know, I'm a piano teacher, and what would be my dream? What would I want in all of this? And then I got to just write it. So
wow. And you're self-published, haven't you?
Yeah, this is the whole interactive method it's actually all me.
Wow. And how long has this taken, Carol?
A year and a half.
Wow.
I mean, I've been writing very fast. It's me and I should say me and a web developer. Thankfully, a friend of mine is a fantastic web developer, and she's custom coded the entire interactive site. So I've done everything from, you know, writing and arranging and putting, you know, doing all the art direction, doing all the recordings, and, you know, I'm doing this full time, working long days.
Yeah. Well, look, I know, you know, how much time and effort I put into a course for my members. And that's, you know, maybe a 10-week plan, let alone a whole, like, this is a whole other level. So I can only imagine how much time you spent on it. And look, the things I look for when it comes to methods is, one, the music's got to be appealing for students. Right. Two, the technique and the introduction of technique and movements of hands, slurs, all that kind of stuff has got to be there, and it's got to be done in a way that students can relate to and remember.
Yes.
So I think that's crucial. That there's backing tracks, and there's also accompaniments for teachers to play along. Do you include some of those as well? or is it mainly MP3s with backings?
They're MP3 tracks. They're piano recordings. So they're not, it's not a bunch of, you know, MIDI orchestrations. Then I would really have no life. So it's one of those things where I'm doing what I can do to get out all of the main stuff. And I have already like 3 years worth of writing scheduled. I'm actually working on Christmas books right now. It's like I said, you know, you're in the music publishing world when Easter or Cinco de Mayo are the days where you're arranging, Christmas pieces.
Yeah.
So it's going to expand. Right now it's levels 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, and then in levels 3 and 4, you'll be very happy to know that's I'm going to get level 3 out probably November. Takes me about 3 months to get a level out, and I'm going to start including, right integrated into the method, playing from lead sheets and chord charts. So that is actually going to be an element so that it is integrated easily for the teacher. You know, this is just one of those things. I know teachers are always scrambling around stack of books and, oh, wait, okay, now let me grab this chord sheet or this, you know, scale thing. And this is a time saver for sure, because this way you have one book and you've got your, you know, your tablet or whatever, and you've got all of your materials in one spot.
I love it. I just got to show you one of my favorite books. Are you familiar with this one?
I don't know what that word is.
So this is the 101 Classical Hits for Buskers. Are you familiar with the 101 series? There's like, I don't know, 50 books in this series. It is brilliant. So it's lead sheets of, there's Largo from the New World Symphony. With chord charts and symbols above it. This, just a classic resource, which was recommended to me by my good friend Paul. And I love this with students. It's one of those things that you can, if a student knows the concept of playing from a lead sheet, then they can turn Largo from the New World into a tango. And it's great fun. So I love that you've included this into a method. Because I remember that Piano Adventures, you know, I think around book 3 maybe, they had one piece which had a lead sheet, chords above. And I thought, wow, this is so cool. They've added this in. And then it's not touched on again. I could not find another mention of it. So so I thought, I don't really understand why. You know, it is such a crucial aspect of learning piano, in my opinion. So it's great that we're including that.
Yeah. Excellent.
Brilliant. All right. So look, your website is carolmatzpiano.com, and very well timed. I don't know if you planned this, but I got an email this morning from you with a free version of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, I think it was.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, that was very clever of you. But actually, this is part of what you offer teachers for free every month, a free arrangement. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's carolmatz at carolmatzpiano.com/free. And again, I just want to say the spelling one more time because it makes me long for Australia because I get to say Z.
Oh, Zed.
carolmatzpiano.com/free. And then once you enter your name and your email address, you'll get access to all my free monthly pieces. And that includes originals, arrangements, duets, even like equal part primo secondo duets. And there's also a lot of really cool teaching resources. Like I did a packet on teaching ragtime, and there are syncopation exercises. How do you really break it down and teach syncopation easily? And then I put in a Joplin arrangement as well. And then also what I think is really important for teachers, a leveling chart is on there as well. This helps make sense out of what concepts the major publishers include at various levels. So this is kind of like a way to decipher what on, you know, earth early intermediate means, or, you know, what are they thinking of it as meaning? And it breaks it down by concept. And that's a nice tool to have. So once you sign up, you'll get a code, and that's going to let you access the archives. So you can actually go on there and get all my freebies for the past couple of years. If you've missed any, you can just go on and click, click, click and download all the PDFs and have them.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for all that you're doing in the piano world. I can't wait to meet you face to face. It's going to be an absolute pleasure. So carolmatzpiano.com. So you would say M-A-T-Z, would you?
Yeah, the American.
M-A-T-Z, okay. Carol Mouth.
We're different with everything.
And you're also on Facebook. You're a prolific supporter of teachers on Facebook, answering comments, sharing ideas and resources. So thank you for popping up there as well and helping other teachers. Anything just to wrap up, or have we pretty much covered everything that we need to?
I don't think that we've done United States Capitals or...
Okay, we're definitely signing off.
No, I really think it was really nice to cover so many bases with you. And again, like my piano doppelganger over there.
Totally.
Kind of just I feel like talking to you is preaching to the choir in a sense. So it's really nice. I know that your listeners, I hope that your listeners will find a lot of things that I said resonate with them since they're familiar with your teaching.
I'm sure they will. So thank you very much, Carol, for your time again today. It's been wonderful to hang out.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
So don't forget to grab the show notes, links to everything we've talked about. That's at timtopham.com/episode89. And also, this is actually the last episode in Pop Teaching Months, which I really hope you've enjoyed. We've had a whole lot of great interviews, blog posts, and podcasts. So if you haven't checked it out yet, there's actually a place on the blog. If you just search POP, you'll be able to find everything that we've talked about. And next week is the start of Business Month on the blog and the podcast, where we'll be helping you with everything you need to grow your business. And we've got some great guests lined up already, including Daniel Patterson from Grow Your Music Studio. We're doing a coaching call with one of my members where I coach them to help answer some of their business questions. And we'll be exploring group teaching, heaps of stuff. I know it's going to be a great way to support and grow your own businesses. So I look forward to seeing you next month. Catch you later.
Ladies and gentlemen, that will conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon PIANOPODCAST for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.